Good morning. This is Doug Box 3166 with the New York Times Magazine article for Sunday morning, September 1st. This article is entitled Tyshawn Jones' jaw-dropping athleticism has made him a skateboarding icon. But is skateboarding big enough for someone like Tyshawn Jones? It's written by Willie Staley of the New York Times Magazine. One of Tyshawn Jones' favorite places to skate is the William Pessinant ball field in Greenwich Village. Even by skateboarding's flexible standards, this park is a barren, flat expanse of asphalt with paint donating a baseball diamond. There are no ledges sweaty with wax, no stairs to jump, not even a measly curb. Once you leave the painted infield, the ground becomes too chunky to really skate on, and yet it's still a destination in New York known to the wilds, to the locals as TF West, a short for training facility. A convoluted inside joke about the fact that there's nothing to skate there, except for trash cans. You can probably use trash cans like these for green, you've probably used trash cans like these for green metal, the ideal height for dropping garbage into about mid-thigh, and provided they don't have too much in them, they make for handy and ad hoc obstacles. Most skaters turn them on their sides, so they just come up to below the knee. Tyshawn Jones generally leaves them upright. He filmed a short clip of a TF West doing nothing but tricks over cans. He tends to clear them so effortlessly that you sense they're less an obstacle than a visual reference point, like a little man included for scale in a drawing of a skyscraper or a whale. Look at how high I can do this. The green colorway of Jones' Adidas Pro Model shoe comes in a miniature plastic replica of a New York City garbage can. The company made some full-size ones at skate shops, too, with Tyshawn in bold letters across the top. It's been a long time since skateboarding has seen a figure like Jones, someone who rapidly, almost out of nowhere, redefines what is physically possible on a board. His skateboarding is, as one of his sponsors, Jason Dill, put to me, the type that anyone in the general public can appreciate. It's easily translatable. The physics of what he's doing is apparent. Jones possesses an unholy combination of vertical leap, flexibility, strength, finesse, and timing, which skaters call somewhat reductively pop. That allows him to launch himself and his board over or onto something, seemingly whatever he wants, sometimes appearing to float for just a beat too long at the apex, as if briefly entering low orbit. Jones first learned about skating from video games, and it sometimes appears his sense of what can be done on a board is influenced by the unnatural laws of those pretend worlds. On a Monday afternoon in December, Jones had been lured to TF West by his clothing sponsor, Supreme, under the impression that he was there simply for an interview with me. He was there, in fact, to be told by Jake Phillips, the editor of Thrasher, that he'd won the magazine's Skater of the Year award, street skateboarding's highest and perhaps only honor. The ceremony wasn't much. Phelps rolled into the park with a cameraman wearing his signature Carhartt vest, and Jones quickly figured out what was going on. "Are you hyped?" Phelps asked. "Hell yeah," Jones said, sealing the deal with a bro grab. Afterwards, someone dragged a trash can out to a spot near shortstop, and Phelps asked Jones to do a switch kickflip over it for Thrasher's camera. Jones, who was about 20, had been sleepy from a combination of Fortnite and jet lag. He'd just returned from Japan, where he'd been with Supreme attending a premiere of Blessed, the company's second full-length video in which he had the coveted and much-talked-about final part. But he seemed re-energized once he had his board in his hands. He had recently been on the cover of Thrasher, shot jumping over a subway entrance in Midtown. He came back from another run at the can and suggested maybe I could talk to someone about getting him on the cover of this magazine, or perhaps he could do better. "I'm trying to get the cover of Vogue," he said. "A Vogue cover?" said the videographer, who was sitting on the ground nearby. "That's hard." Jones might have been kidding but he was onto something. The worlds of fashion and skateboarding have been commingling somewhat uncomfortably for years now, with models and celebrities wearing Thrasher hoodies. And even, yes, Vogue.com once dedicated a week of coverage to the pursuit. The black hole in the center of this galaxy is Supreme, a somewhat mysterious operation that seems only to grow in influence and scale. It's a New York skate shop that became a fashion behemoth, sweeping up Tyshawn Jones when he was just 12 and spitting out one of the most exciting skateboarders in a generation, one who is now, by the way, represented by DNA Model Management. That day, Jones came became the first New Yorker ever to win the SOTY. Nearly every winner before him has been a Californian by birth or by choice. Jones was also the last to be anointed by Phelps, who was widely rumored to handpick the winner. Phelps died in March. It was tempting to see Thrasher's decision to select him as a tacit acknowledgement of skateboarding's eastward drift away from the West Coast slovenly comforts and into the frigid embrace of the fashion industry. In a more straightforward sense, though, Jones was being knighted for doing the impossible, bending the chaos of New York City to his and his skateboard's will. Flat, old, crowded, full of plazas, people actually use, and cramped schoolyards kept under lock and key, and at least for the time being subject to snowy winters, New York possesses none of the blessings, natural and unnatural, that molded the sport in its ancestral home, California. But Jones, armed with his pop and his willingness to do battle with the crowds that make filming in New York so difficult, had managed to turn the city's liabilities into assets. Once filming on Park Avenue, he rode in front of a gigantic mover, stopping it dead in its tracks. Then on a whim, hopped up about waist high to do a board slide on its shovel. It's one thing to be good at skateboarding, Dill said. It's another thing to read the city like that. Even at a godforsaken place like TF West, you still have to compete with other desperate souls seeking open space, mostly people playing roller hockey and kickball. Before Jones had a chance to stomp his trick, the diamond was swarmed with what appeared to be a kindergarten class. "I ain't got time for these little rugrats," he said, surveying the scene. Still, he managed to find a lane through the throng to sneak in a few more attempts. Then an adult woman approached the can. It seemed as if she might put an end to the session by dragging the thing away, instantly turning TF West back to the passionate ball field. What nobody expected was for her to use the trash can the way a vast majority of the population tend to use one, by putting trash into it, which is exactly what she did. Jones picked up skateboarding when he was 10, right around the time something truly calamitous befell him and his family. He was born in New York but lived in New Jersey at the time, where his mother, Tamisha Henry, had moved to the family so he and his older brother Brian could get into a better school district. She was keeping most of her life savings stashed in her bedroom. She had her reasons, but even so, $80,000 isn't easily hidden from two little boys. Tyshawn and Brian soon figured out where it was, and they would pick at it, in Tyshawn's words, to buy skateboards and movie tickets. The family lived in the biggest unit in a condo building in Hackensack, a nice place with a doorman and shared swimming pool. Sometimes friends would come over to use the pool. Once Brian showed off the gigantic pile of cash to a couple of friends from school. Those same friends came back one day when Tyshawn was home alone, asking if they could go for a swim. Tyshawn let them in. They asked if they could use the bathroom beforehand, both of them. Tyshawn sent one down the hall and the other upstairs to the bathroom off the master bedroom. The one he sent upstairs came back down holding his towel awkwardly in front of him and said they changed their minds and didn't feel like swimming anymore. Tyshawn sent them on their way. "I'm a kid. I'm not thinking anything," he told me. "I'm like 10 years old." A few days later, when he was at school, his mother called him in tears. Nearly all the money was missing. Henry went to the police only to be told that she couldn't press charges against the boys unless she also pressed charges against her own sons, who were technically involved. Not only was the money gone, but Brian had to watch the thieves enjoy it. They were probably 13 years old with $80,000 cash, Tyshawn said. There's so much money they were giving away at school. Left with an overwhelming sense of guilt, Tyshawn started casting about for ways to help replace the money. He was a clever kid. He tricked the doorman into looking for something in the package room, then snatched apartment keys off the wall. "I was young and dumb," he says. He thought everyone had huge piles of cash hidden in their bedrooms. They didn't, but he found other stuff to grab. He eventually got caught, and in the aftermath of all this, the family moved back to Bronx. "When I moved to New York, I just couldn't think about that money," Jones said. "I got to get that money back for my mom. I got to get that money back for my mom." The Bronx was not the best place to start a career in skateboarding. Few late 20th century subcultures could afford to treat New York City as a backwater, but skateboarding sort of did. The city was certainly less important to the big skate magazines, all based in California, than asinine bits of Orange County like Huntington Beach and Costa Mesa. A result of this neglect was that New York skateboarding became something of a subculture within a subculture. If the magazines and videos were overrun with guys in ripped jeans hurling themselves over down handrails in California parking lots, New Yorkers wore slightly cooler clothes and focused more on style, on grace, on finding and repurposing the right scrap of the city in the exact right way. A major quirk of Tyshawn's career, though, is that he worshipped California skaters who hurled themselves down handrails. And though he would eventually make a name for himself as a brilliant street skater, Jones learned how to skate primarily at New York's network of skate parks, which were popping up all over the city around the time his family returned to the Bronx. Skate parks are fine to use, but it's considered sacrilegious in street skateboarding to film at a park, and vaguely uncool to spend too much time at them. Dill got worked up when I suggested to him that Jones had done so. He grew up in a skate park, he said. It's called New York City. Todd Jordan, who helped manage the Supreme Skate Team, was more willing to concede the point. You can only go so far at Tompkins, he said, referring to the original TF in the East Village, to which, as the joke goes, Passanant is the Western Annex. I hate to give skate parks credit, but it did something for New York. One day, someone showed a clip of Jones skating to Ty Lyons, who works at Supreme's flagship shop on Lafayette Street. Jones had done a 360 flip down 9 stairs somewhere in Battery Park. Doing stuff like that, he was breaking 6 boards a month. Lyons was impressed and wanted to hook him up with free boards from Supreme. Jones agreed, but then didn't show up for months. I wasn't like that, Jones said. I don't like asking people for stuff. Crudely speaking, though, stuff is the engine that keeps the whole subculture of skateboarding in motion. Talented skaters are given free stuff, and all they have to do in exchange is film themselves using the stuff. If they get good enough, the companies will actually pay them to use the stuff exclusively. If they're really good, they get their name on the stuff, mostly boards and shoes, and typically a share of the royalties. The whole apparatus is sort of a Rube Goldberg machine powered by sponsored content. At one end, a guy spends 5 hours struggling to get one clip, and at the other end, a teenager begs his mother to buy his board. At 12, Jones was on the first step of his ladder, having found a local skate shop willing to give him those boards free. But Supreme was, at this point, a skate shop in name only. Since its founding in Soho in 1994, it had become an enormous international streetwear brand with stores in Los Angeles, London, and Tokyo. It now has stores in Brooklyn and Paris, several more in Japan, and will soon open in San Francisco. Selling clothes is a much better business than selling skateboards because of the simple fact that not many people buy skateboards, but everyone buys clothes. It's perhaps helpful to think of skate companies as being like monks who sell cheese by letting outsiders buy goods imbued vaguely with their magic. Skaters can go on living in their strange cloistered world. No company has performed this alchemy better, more successfully than Supreme, which sells fetish objects so powerful they become financial instruments. Their clothes are so sought after that many people buy them solely to flip on a thriving secondary market. Jones didn't know any of that when Lyons approached him. All he knew was that Supreme's hats seemed popular. Eventually, a friend dragged him there to get some new hardware, and Lyons finally persuaded Jones to start coming in. Right around then, Supreme hired William Strobeck, an accomplished photographer and videographer from upstate New York. He started filming with Jones all over downtown, working on Supreme's full-length skate video, Cherry. Strobeck encouraged Jones to do as many tricks as he could into what skaters call the courthouse drop on Foley Square, an iconic New York spot. Joshua Mueller, who works for Adidas Skateboarding, started hearing rumors about a kid getting incredible footage at the courthouse. Jones had learned a lot about the industry in the intervening years, and he put off having a conversation with Mueller until after the video came out. Then the two finally met. They did so at Foley Square. One of the first questions Jones asked Mueller is, how can I get my own shoe? Jones was, at this point, living something of a double life, dressing as a little skate rat running around downtown and wearing Jordans and True Religious uptown with his friends while doing, as he put it somewhat critically, bad stuff. Sometimes he got grief about his passion from his friends who thought skateboarding as a white sport. I didn't give an expletive about what they said, he told me, like, y'all broke, I don't care what y'all got to say. He might have not cared much about school, but as he saw it, at least he had a reason. I would never fail school just to hang out in the area I live in, like, that's stupid, he said, or be disruptive in school just to hang out on the block, like, that's dumb. As Strobeck sees it, that journey from Bronx to Manhattan is captured symbolically in the trick that put Jones on the cover of Thrasher, an ollie over an entrance to the 6th train at the 33rd Street station. This subway entrance is a mind-boggling thing to leap over. The gap starts in an office building's elevated plaza, and from there you have to clear a thigh-high guardrail over a 6-foot-wide staircase plunging down to the street with a spiked-tipped fence on the other end. But the ollie itself was just a fraction of the challenge. Midtown was swarming with people whenever they went to film. One thing Jones has that a lot of pro skaters don't is a bunch of hard-headed friends who were willing to bring city life to a halt for him. The day he finally landed on his third visit, he went to the spot with 10 of his buddies, mostly of whom didn't skate. They positioned themselves all around the subway entrance to help, in Strobik's word, facilitate, or the exact opposite, depending on your perspective. One stood in the stairwell to keep unwitting strap hangers from taking a board to the skull. One stood at the top to keep people from going down the stairs, and some dealt with people in the plaza above. Another worked as a spotter to tell Jones when the coast was clear. Even passersby stopped to help. To ollie over something this massive is like doing a parabolic calculus problem with your body while also attempting suicide. It involves a set of motions Jones knows like second nature. Snap the tail and leap, dragging the board as high as you can with your front foot, tucking your knees into your body on the Thrasher cover. Jones are practically touching his shoulders, then hope for the best. When Jones finally landed it, he did so with his front wheels on the street and his rear wheels up on the sidewalk. One last screw you from New York, but he rode away. He got a message on Instagram from someone who worked in a building high above the plaza. She told him that people in the office had lined up at the windows to watch. When he landed it, the whole place erupted in cheers. On a Thursday afternoon in May, Jones was driving through the Bronx to the skate park in Throgs Neck, the first one he skated regularly in New York. A couple of blocks from his apartment, we passed an abandoned vinyl-sided house next to an overgrown vacant lot. "That's a gold mine right there," he said. I asked him if he was looking to invest in real estate, and he said, "Yeah, that's my next move," he said. "This skate expletive don't pay enough. I need a Rolls Royce." He was kidding, sort of. His Adidas Pro model was scheduled for release in a few weeks, and I asked him what they looked like. "I'm wearing them," he said. By now, they were stuck in traffic. We were stuck in traffic under the Bruckner Expressway, so he reached beneath the steering wheel and pulled one off, hitting the overhead light so I could get a better look. It's generally understood that a pro shoe is the only way to make any real money in skateboarding, something I said aloud. "That's what I heard," Jones said. His voice bears the markers of his unique biography. A Bronx accent with vowels all stretched out and flattened like taffy. "Oh, you'll be rich when you get a shoe." I'm like, "I'll believe it when I see it." Because shoe deals are the financial pinnacle of a street skateboarding career. Fates are vexingly lashed to consumer sentiment outside skateboarding, which can lead to strange outcomes. There's a famous, possibly apocryphal story about a skater named Dave Mayhew, not the most memorable guy, who turned up late to an important meeting with his shoe sponsor, Osiris, and got stuck with the one design no one else wanted. These went on to become one of the best-selling skate shoes of all time, the D3. I brought up Stefan Janoski, a skater who designed a shoe with Nike in 2009 that is still made today in so many varieties that one of Nike's current pros, Shane O'Neill, has his name on a modified Janoski. Janoski is hardly the most consequential skater of all time, but he's probably among the most financially successful. The situation is as if Nike had a flagship sub-brand called Air Pippin. Jones, it turned out, had seen Janoski recently. He's loaded. I mean, he ain't a billionaire, but he's probably got 15 or 20 million to his name, which is good for a skater who wasn't like in contests. He just did it his way. He had good parts, but he wasn't like a Nia. That's Nia Houston, a frequent X Game champion and an announced member of the Team USA in the 2020 Olympic Games. He probably got Nia money, and look what Nia had to do to get that money. What Houston had to do is become a widely mocked figure in skateboarding despite being technically one of the best athletes. Though he does skate street, Houston takes a lot of money in contests, which tend to reward the mindless reproduction of the same tricks on a course designed to enable them, all antithetical to the ingenuity, perseverance, and risk-taking that his skateboarding is meant to be about. Houston is also notorious for wearing a Monster Energy drink hat just about everywhere he goes. "Everybody don't like him, but I respect him," Jones went on. He's one of the only niggas who really got rich skating, like really rich, like $2 million crib, like a Lamborghini. I think that's right. There's skaters who can't even get by with $500 a month. Monster Energy is plainly an interloper in skate culture. Supreme is something more conceptually amorphous, a billion-dollar fashion brand partly owned by the Carlyle Group, which is also, technically speaking, a chain of skate shops. Monster Energy sells energy drinks and the dynamic lifestyle that energy drink consumption suggests, but what it is that Supreme sells is a question with a fuzzier answer. Its clothing comes wrapped with a dense thicket of cultural references that seem to endlessly revisit the moment of the company's conception. In mid-1990s lower Manhattan, an extreme high-low collision of fine art, hip-hop, skateboarding, and occasionally petty criminality. It has sold branded bricks, crowbars, and bolt cutters, all of which now sell for hundreds of dollars on the secondary market. Jones Part and Blessed contained what is probably a record amount of footage of confrontations with security guards, beginning with a short one in New York and ending with a drawn-out one in Paris. In the middle, a bicycle-mounted security guard in Los Angeles nearly pulls out his pepper spray on him. Strobeck told me he wanted to show how hard Jones worked for his clips, and the footage certainly has the intended effect. Jones, for his part, never gets into physical altercation with guards, instead relying on a sophisticated sort of game theory. You just work here. You don't have authority over me. You don't have a gun, so you're not going to make me leave. I'm going to do this trick. You're going to watch. Call the cops in the meantime if you're passionate about it. But I'm passionate about what I do, too. These confrontations are a staple of skate videos, but in the hands of a fashion brand with the fixation Supreme has, it can't seem that intentionally or not, Jones' tenacity has become subtly commodified, turned into an extension of its aestheticism vision of urban anarchy. Just 20 years old, Jones is already 8 years into his career as a skateboarder and thinking about what comes next. He opened a restaurant in the Bronx when he was 19 and co-founded his own hardware company, Hardee's, which of course also sells branded clothing. In fact, he was wearing Hardee's gear on a recent Friday as we hung out under the banana-colored sign of his restaurant, a Caribbean-American spot called Taste So Good, Make You Want to Smack Your Mama. I asked her if he had any plans for the summer. He had to do a lot for Adidas in the next few weeks, he said. Then after that, my schedule is pretty free, just chillin', Six Flags, paintball, you know what I'm saying, regular, expletive, trampoline world, go-karts. I was suddenly reminded how young he is, but how unusually mature. He employs his own mother, who runs a restaurant. His debt to her finally on its way to being repaid. Tastes So Good is a small place with a promotional poster for Blessed on the wall. It is packed for the lunch rush, so we stopped out front to talk. Jones propped one leg up on the windowsill. Little LEDs blinked behind him pointlessly in the daylight. Termisha Henry emerged after the rush died down with a plate of cold-cut watermelon. Jones grabbed a slice and told his mom something he mentioned to me earlier, offhandedly, in minutes earlier. "Ma, I fell into a pole and hit my balls," he said. "They hurt." "That's normal," she said. "They've been hurting for 3 days," he said. "One of them's bigger than the other. Should I go to the hospital?" Henry said that she knew someone who'd gotten beaten pretty badly by the cops in the same area. They try to get you where it hurts, but when he went to the hospital, he found out there was nothing that could be done about it. Jones seemed relieved. "I don't want to go to the hospital either," he said. I wondered aloud if his sponsor offered health insurance. They do not, which is industry standard because pro skaters are contractors, not employees. The reminder was enough to set off Henry into a protective rant. "You've got people sitting in the office behind a computer, but you got them under medical," she said. "I'm here filming for you, flying off everything you can think about so you can get good photos and marketing, whatever they do with the photos, that builds their brand just as much as you. And you don't want to pay for health insurance? That makes no sense to me." Though she eventually came around, Henry has been leery of Jones' sponsors ever since Supreme first approached him. "You can't depend on these companies forever," she reminded, telling him. "They use you until they can't use you anymore." She went on, "Don't ever think they just love you and just want to give you this and that. No, they got something, get something out of it, so make sure you always get yours." Jones was sitting on a chair he'd pulled out of the restaurant, brushing his hair and looking at Instagram, experiencing the universal horror of being embarrassed by his mother. "They ain't gonna like this," he said. But the conversation turned into a lively discussion on the value of labor and curious and opaque corner of the economy that Jones has managed to rise to the top of. Henry mentioned in an acquaintance who has paid $36,000 to make 6 posts on Instagram. Jones wasn't terribly impressed. "I know people who get $100,000 a post and $200,000 a post," he said. He'd recently broken up with Sarah Snyder, a model with 1.7 million followers on Instagram, and I suspect he was thinking of her. A lot of people make money off these brands these days. Jones had struck me over the months, and I was in conversation with him, as if he were searching for the next summit and feeling stymied. I found this surprising, as it was almost impossible for me to think of a better life at 20, but listening to him and Henry talk, it started to make sense. Skateboarding prefigured an influencer economy that has come to overtake everything. Now, anyone can aspire to work without really working, document it, and then have some brand pay them to do it. And if they succeed, they can probably make way more money than someone as gifted as Tyshawn Jones can, hemmed in by as he is by the size of the industry and the subculture norms that have shaped it and him. These norms have both benefited him and circumscribed his potential. They prevent skateboarding from becoming something as boring as a sport, but as a result, Jones may never be recognized as a world-class athlete. He arguably is. It was the week of the NBA Finals, and the two began discussing the truly galling amount of money basketball players make. Throwing a ball in a hoop, Jones said dismissively. Curry got $237 million for 5 years. It hadn't occurred to me just how rote the work of an athlete might look to a pro skater, who must do so much more than just perform. He has to find spots, think of tricks, overcome not his fear, just his fears, but also the police, good Samaritans, cracks in the pavement, rain. And only once that chaos has been mitigated can he begin to perform, to write one little line in the canon of an insular subculture. Henry joked that her son had gotten into the wrong sport entirely. Throwing a ball in a hoop, he said. Again, that expletive is crazy. During the last month of filming for Blessed, Jones went to Madison Square Garden somewhere between 15 and 20 times by his estimate. There was a rail there on the 7th Avenue side, a level round thing running alongside two small sets of stairs. To skate it, you need to clear a 5-foot gap from the top set of stairs before you even reach the rail. Jones was hoping to do a kickflip front board slide, meaning he would flip his board while turning 90 degrees to what so that when he caught it again, he would have cleared the gap and landed with the middle of his board balanced on the rail. Sliding perhaps 10 feet while looking over his shoulder at where he was going and dismounting off a neck-high drop onto the sidewalk. He filmed it at dawn before the place became the mouth to Penn Station, one of the busiest railroad stations in the country. Strobick would get up at 4:45 a.m., grab his camera, and meet Jones, who had driven down from the Bronx. At least once, Jones spent the night in his car to save the trip. He went there so much that security guards started to wait outside for him, knowing he'd be showing up. Because of the material is made of, the rail at MSG is a bit sticky. Jones kept hanging up, not making it to the end. He tried everything, or at least the only two things you can try, wax and going faster, and he just couldn't land it before the deadline. There's another spot in Midtown where Jones came back so many times that security guards eventually relented, figuring correctly that if he got his trick, he'd stop showing up. Jones got that one, and it's now the centerpiece of a massive billboard in Soho advertising his shoes with Adidas. I asked him once if he thought he was going to get the trick at MSG, and he told me in no uncertain terms that he would. Even if the security guards don't yield to his determination, there's every reason to assume that the laws of physics will. And that is the end of today's New York Times Magazine. Have a great day.